Here did our human fathers take their places, fain to fulfill the sacred law of worship. The Rig Veda, Mandala 4, 1.13. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. This week, we will be revisiting the site of Maragar. Between the time frame of this season, which is, of course, 6,000 to 4,000 BC. Before I start that, I do want to thank everyone who listened last week. Sorry, there were some audio issues. I was also very tired. I recorded that episode at different times. And as you probably saw, it came out a little late. I fell asleep at some point while the episode was rendering as a video, so I did not get it up at the normal time. Apologies for that. For Maragar, we will see the end of its first and second phase, as well as we might get into the start of the third phase. We'll see, this might turn into like a kind of a two-part for Maragar, a part for Maragar here, and then next week's episode will be the finish off Maragar for this season, and then we'll be talking about some other places along kind of the Indus River area. Before that, we're going to talk about some feedback that I had from last week. We talked in depth about Maragar last season, but I'll probably repeat some of that information, though how much, I'm not really sure. So you may want to go back and re-listen, though there has been some new information published or that I found since then that made some stuff maybe outdated or maybe shifted the timeline some. So keep that in mind if something I say here contradicts something I said there. I would say this episode is newer and should be considered more accurate and up to date. Before all that, I did have a couple of people ask me to define the step with a little more detail, and I think that's a good idea, especially with our episode on Central Asia so fresh in our minds, and due to the fact that we will be returning kind of to parts of that area later this season as we move back west from Eastern Asia. Essentially, the Eurasian Steppe, or the Great Steppe, is a band of grasslands that spread, as the name suggests, from Europe to Asia for around 5,000 miles, which is about 8,000 kilometers, with a few relatively small breaks. And this is considered kind of a temperate biome, though the winters can be very harsh. To my U.S. listeners, the closest thing we have to this environment is the prairies of the Great Plains. They're very similar. And there are other parts of the world with similar environments. I think Argentina has, you know, areas that would be comparable. I think southwestern Australia, the southern island of New Zealand, parts of South Africa or Southern Africa have grasslands, though they are drier and not as temperate. So they don't have those devastating winters. Now, the Eurasian Steppe can be divided into smaller sections and regions, though these are not agreed upon by everyone. And some of the divisions are done by geography, some are done culturally, and some are done by environmental and or biological factors. Now, some of these divisions overlap with each other fairly well. Others are less useful, depending on your discipline. Typically speaking, I'll be using cultural terms, because that's more what involved with history. Though, due to the nature of recorded history, certain cultural divisions might be unclear until certain periods of time, so I might revert, or will revert, to geographic terms, or use some theoretical divisions. And one big division that I will point out at the start is the division between the Eastern and Western Steppe. And these are separated from each other by the Altai mountain range. Now, there are some small stretches of grassland that ring the mountains to the north, but they're broken up by forests and other things, so that the two portions are not connected. There is a small break between the eastern and western steppe. The eastern steppe is smaller. It has pockets of deserts, hills, and mountains that are surrounded by grasslands. The greater Kigan Mountains break this up before you cross them, and then you have a small section of what is considered the Eurasian steppe in Manchuria, where it ends. Now, the western steppe runs from the Altai west all the way into the Danube River in what is now Romania. Now, there is also a smaller section on the other side of the Carpathian Mountains, and this is called by some as the Pannonian Steppe. It is in parts of what is now modern-day Hungary, and I think parts of Austria, too. It's almost a mirror into the small section of the steppe in Manchuria. Now, for how far it spreads north to south, this is much harder to answer because it varies wildly. You have forests to the north in places in what is now Russia, Russian Siberia, and to the south you have deserts in more arid regions, like portions of Central Asia that we talked about last week, as well as mountains in those regions, and also what is now northwestern China. And we'll be covering the steppes more when we move north from East Asia and then west into Europe, where we will definitely, or we will briefly touch on the remaining sections of Central Asia. For now, though, let's dive into the primary focus of this week's episode, the proto/emerging city of Mirgar. We've talked before about how different places and times described cities differently. But last season, we talked how around 7,000 BC or so, Mirgar became inhabited by humans on a permanent or semi-permanent basis. Now, there were probably a small population living at the site year-round. But these numbers would fluctuate as various groups would move in and out of the site. And these first inhabitants were herders of sheep and goats, possibly cattle, too. There is some debate as to whether or not the earliest bones there are from domesticated herds or wild cattle that were being hunted. They used Neolithic types of tools, so you had the small microbladelets. They also initially planted crops, though agriculture, at the earliest dates, there was not the primary food source. And it was, you know, not the sole focus of the lives of the people who were living there. Now, over the next 1,000 years or so, to the start of this season, this does start to change. You have crops like wheat and barley becoming much more important. And eventually, domesticated cattle definitely emerge and enter the picture. So, again, by 6,000, Mirgar had grown in size. The people living there full-time are much more numerous than the people who are probably living there seasonally, and they had developed a much more complex society. They had large amounts of non-utilitarian artifacts, things made from seashells, turquoise, lapis lazuli, and many other types of material. Seashells and lapis, by the way, aren't exactly close to Mirgar. The closest source of lapis is in what is now modern Afghanistan. And while I'm sure, you know, there were probably some small shells along the Indus River, the amount and type we found tend to suggest that they're probably importing them from areas to the south further, or closer to the coast, excuse me. Now, this shows that they had long-range trade and contact, as well as long-term trade and contact with these regions. This is not something that's happening every so often. It's something that's fairly, you know, regular. Now, they were also producing clay figures of peoples and animals. The human statues appear to all be female, or they're, if they're not readily apparently to be female, they're too damaged to identify as another way. They're also making their homes of unbaked mud bricks, and they were used, the homes were divided internally into four rooms of about even size. Some might have like a smaller third room, and you know, or three rooms the same size, and then like a smaller fourth room. It does vary a little bit. They buried their dead simply at first, so right around the start of the season. But as time goes on, they become much more elaborate burials, and people are buried with more grave goods, tools, ornaments, weapons, and they even leave them offerings of food, including meat. We found the bones and all that kind of stuff from the animals. And this is done for both men and women, though technically I think they've determined that the men had a bit more variety in the goods, and in a lot of cases, more of the goods. And we see these developments happen slowly over time in the stratigraphy in the region. And this continues from 6,000 for another 500 years or so, until right around 5,500 BC. After this point, pottery begins to appear in Maragar. Prior to this time, it was a ceramic site. It did not use pottery. Now, the pottery is simple at first, but this changes quickly, and I know it seems like I've said this many times this season, because I have, because it's true. But, like those other sites, it does, again, change quickly. It becomes more detailed, better made, more even. Other changes are going along, are happening to their other types of artistic expression. The clay figures become much better made. They're done in an early form of terracotta, which is a special type of clay fired at low temperatures, and this kind of gives it almost a glassy sheen. And they would even paint these figures in a couple of different colors. Red, I think, is popular, or the most popular. And they would also give more detail to the figures they're depicting. They would give them smaller, well, they would make it look like they were wearing, you know, things like the jewelry that they were creating themselves. So these figures become much more detailed. They begin to reflect, probably the people that were living at the time, or at least an idealized version of these people, possibly a goddess. It's impossible to say. And they're also making new types of jewelry as well, in addition to continuing their older types. One of these ornaments is a new invention, another new invention, and these are faience beads. Now, I believe I mentioned faience when I was talking about Egypt, but this is another place that has this. And the term faience could be misleading. And when you see it mentioned in the context of the early societies, it's important to remember this is not modern faience. Modern faience is made with a kind of a lead or tin glaze that's kind of laid over ceramics that also give them a glassy sheen. And these were first produced in Europe in the 15th century. In earlier times, and in societies that don't have metallurgy, they're made with a material known as frit. And that's F-R-I-T. And frit can be made with a number of different materials. I think quartz, limestone, things like that. Essentially, it's crushed up, added to mixtures. But Maragar is possibly the first place this technique was used. The other option is the Egyptians. Either way, each developed the techniques independently. In Maragar, they used it to make glossy blue beads. Egyptians also used it to make similar items. And that's kind of the first step for both of these societies. They're making faience beads. Eventually, they'll make other items. Now, the Egyptians had access to materials to make green in addition to blue, whereas Maragar, it seems like they're only able to make blue faience, at least at this earlier stage. In fact, I think, as far as I know, Egypt may be the only place where they're able to make green faience, at least for quite a while. Eventually, I think this does spread to other areas. So, this phase of Marigar sees a lot of advancement in the various ways that you manufacture and produce non-utilitarian items. Another change is that's going on is in the burial styles. The burials still happen. They are including less grave goods, though. They aren't including tools, and very little food is added in the graves, if any food at all. But they are still including ornamentation. They're also covering the dead in red ochre, sometimes a large amount. Now, this isn't something that's new. A lot of different places have used red ochre to kind of cover the bodies, and this is used even after this period in other places. But it seems like it became much more important to the burial rituals here. Now, why this change has happened is debatable. You would think with them producing more and fancier types of jewelry, they would have more of it to bury. So there are theories. None of them are particularly convincing to me. It may be that they were producing these goods for trade. There could have become a more stratified society, and only certain people actually had the means to bury their dead with goods. But these are all, again, debated. We're not really sure. Now, another change that is happening is also highly debated, and we're not 100% sure. There's a little bit of kind of evidence for it, but how much it's affecting things is kind of debated, and that is the makeup of the population. It appears that there are groups coming up from further south of the Indus River flow. Remember, Marigar itself is not on this Indus River. It's kind of to the north west of the Indus River. It's fairly close. Like you're close enough you could get to it without too much of a hassle, but it does appear that groups are coming up from the south of the Indus River. Now, this is not a large-scale invasion or anything like that. There's not a uptick in violence. There's no destructive lairs or anything like that at Marigar. Now, there are, you know, probably a lot of smaller villages and hamlets and things like that kind of on the outskirts that we haven't located, or that just aren't, you know, super heavily populated, or that haven't been discovered yet. And this isn't too surprising. The area is very fertile at this time. It's good land for crops and for animals. Marigar, especially being closer to the foothills of the Hindu Kush, that's a great place to take your herds out and kind of graze on the hills and things like that, at least for your sheep and your goats. The evidence for outsiders coming in, you see tools and artifacts that are very similar to those areas begin to show up in areas around Marigar. Now, again, there's not evidence of large-scale violence. I'm sure there was violence on some scale, but not anything out of the ordinary that you're seeing between other sites and other, you know, villages that had, you know, probably been occupied by the same people who had been occupying Marigar. There's constantly violence in all of these Neolithic places. I haven't really touched on it too much because there's not a whole lot of concrete evidence of who's attacking who. These people are all related to each other in some way. But it's just a question of how closely and what's causing the conflict. But again, it's not large scale. But Marigar, being where it's situated, is a very prosperous site. And you can see this, like, the population is growing at a very standard, or above standard clip. I know last season I mentioned that I had heard someone say that there were 70,000 people living at Miragar. Now, during last season's time period, that number was probably unbelievable. Towards the end or the end of this season, that number becomes much more believable. And I think by the end of Miragar, it will have reached that point. And then, you know, it begins to fall off again. And we'll get into that later. But it's a good place. It's definitely attracting attention from outsiders. It's very possible that these outsiders were coming in to trade and get these new goods that Miragar was producing. And there's no, you know, there's no reason to believe that this wasn't something that Miragar did not take advantage of. But this is all speculation, really, until we find some other sites or any, you know, something along those lines. Now, there are some other developments that are happening in Miragar at this time. They're developing kilns fairly quickly. They are creating groundstone axes. These are kind of our polished stone axes. These are something, I think, in South Asia. This is the first site that you'll find something like that in this area. So Miragar is really a center of that just kind of explodes in terms of creativity and innovation for the entire Indian subcontinent at this point. And it will continue to be so because this period, the 5500 Miragar period 2, it begins and it ends right around 4800 BCE. And that kind of gets us into the next phase where you see other sites begin to emerge neighboring Miragar, or at least, you know, not direct neighbors, but they're close enough that they definitely had contact with each other. And we're going to be talking about phase 3 next week and the changes going along with that. And then after we finish up phase 3 with Miragar, or at least the first 800 years of phase 3, phase 3 lasts for, I believe, let's see, 4,800 to 3,500, I believe. So over 1,000 years. It's longer. Well, I guess it's technically about as long as phase 2. But that's something we'll talk about next week. Then we'll also be covering these other sites that are beginning to emerge in the region as a whole. But Miragar is a very interesting place. Very long lasting. I think it's probably one of the longest lasting sites that we'll discuss. Though, again, it goes through a lot of changes. But it doesn't fall victim to some of the downfalls of these other long-lasting places like Jericho. It's never completely abandoned like Jericho is. It does see population dips at times, but there's never an out-and-out abandonment until much, much later. And we'll go over that, of course, when we get there. But that's in the future. We still have a lot of interesting innovation and growth in the region before that happens. So, thank you all for joining me this week. I hope this episode hasn't been too short. Seems like the shorter episodes have been fairly well received, at least in terms of downloads, so I'm hoping that will continue. But, yeah, I hope you all have enjoyed. If you have any questions, feedback, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can reach me via direct message on Twitter/X. You can comment on my YouTube videos. I do respond there. It may take me a little bit. I do stream on YouTube as well, usually during the week, sometimes on the weekends as well. I play history games. Sometimes I play other stuff that interests me personally. But if you see I'm live, feel free to drop in and say hey, and talk there if you'd like. But yeah, I hope everyone has a good and safe week. Where I live has seen a lot of unusual winter weather. We usually have, you know, cold winters, but not too too much precipitation. But we had some snowstorms here, and that kind of threw everyone for a loop. It caused me to have to, you know, do some quick work to kind of catch up for this week's episode. But I think it turned out okay, and no one was hurt in the family. Nothing was damaged, so all in all, I'm counting myself blessed on that front. So anyway, thank you all. I hope you have a good day from whenever you listen to this, and a good rest of your week. I'll see you all next time. Take care. Goodbye.